any of the new lawyers were here to watch that, excuse me, if any of the new lawyers who just got sworn in saw that, they saw the two counsels shake hands afterwards, we think that's a very, very good thing.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Paul D. Cullen, Sr., and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Petitioner Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, sometimes referred to as OIDA, O-O-I-D-A. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The case before you involves the general concept of medical qualification of drivers of these large 18-wheelers that you see go down the highway all the time. You can divide this topic into two parts, one of which is relevant to your decision today, the other is not. The first part deals with the objective qualifications of individual drivers, eyesight, reflexes, blood pressure, disabling diseases, things like this. You may assume for the purposes of this case that the rules and approaches to these problems are the same in the United States among all the 50 states, Canada and Mexico. You can make that assumption. The second part of the qualification process involves something very different, and that is the processes and procedures used to determine whether an individual satisfies the standards that we just mentioned. What are the qualifications and training of the people who make those examinations? What are their credentials? What kind of oversight are they subject to? These are very important in the context of this case. In the year 2005, Congress passed what is now codified in 49 U.S. Code 31149. Passed very specific directions which instructed the Secretary of Commerce how this examination of individual drivers should take place, 2005. That statute in 31149C1B requires that drivers have a current valid medical certificate. In subsection D1, the Secretary is directed to establish a national registry of medical examiners qualified to perform the investigations, and there are a number of qualifications that are added in various subsections. Finally, the Secretary is instructed that he may accept as valid only medical certificates issued by persons on the national registry. In the rulemaking, which is the subject of our petition for review, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration exempted Canadian and Mexican drivers from this requirement that all drivers have a current and valid certificate. That is beyond the authority of the Secretary, and it's not in accordance with law unless there is some excuse, some exemption possible. And the only one offered by Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is that there are pre-existing international agreements which accept and allow for such exceptions to this very straightforward statutory requirement. That issue about the implications of pre-existing agreements in turn can be divided into two questions. One, are there agreements that create obligations on behalf of the United States which are incompatible with the requirements that we just discussed that were enacted by Congress in 2005? And if there are such incompatibilities between these international agreements, is the language of the 2005 statute so clear and unambiguous that it trumps the pre-existing agreements, international agreements, and abrogates inconsistent provisions? We look first at the so-called 1991 Memorandum of Understanding that was negotiated between the United States and Mexico. And this appears in the addendum, I believe, starting at around page 7, but it goes through page 13 of the addendum. If you look carefully at that memorandum of understanding, you will find no obligations undertaken on behalf of the United States of America with respect to medical certification of the qualifications of drivers. What you find is an acknowledgement that Mexico does this one way, the United States does it another way, and the United States agrees to take a trip to Mexico to look and see how they do it down there, and with a view, perhaps, of adopting the Mexican approach. That's all you find. All right? There is no undertaking in the agreement itself with respect to how medical certification takes place. Therefore, when you look at the 2005 statute, there is no conflicting international agreement with Mexico that would prohibit you or allow the Secretary to avoid his responsibilities there with respect to Mexican drivers. The second point applies to the Canadian agreement, which does make reference to the method and procedures for measuring driver qualifications. And if you were to look at the Mexican agreement and find that there's some undertaking there that the United States is responsible, you move to phase two, which is to examine the 2005 statute. And under the cases decided by this court, particularly Fund for the Animals versus Kempthorne, if the language of the later enacted statute is clear and unambiguous, it trumps any pre-existing international agreement.
Well, that's not quite clear to me. In Fund for Animals, the name of the statute that trumped was the Amended Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So it was clearly a statute that Congress knew full well that they were amending a previous statute about the treaty. This statute that we're talking about here says nothing about any previous treaty or executive agreement. The statute we're talking about here says nothing about Mexico or Canada. The statute we're talking about here says nothing about the possibility of affecting foreign drivers. So what is the best case you have for the application of this canon in a circumstance in which neither on the face of the statute nor in the legislative history is there any indication that Congress knew or intended to affect a foreign government?
That assumes that there is an articulated, clear statement rule, which I don't believe there is.
I'm not assuming anything. I'm just asking you, has any case ever gone as far as you want us to go in this case, which is to say that when a statute is clear on its face, but does not mention a foreign government or its possible effect, and there's no other indication in legislative history that that alone is going to be enough?
Roeder 1 and Roeder 2, which we discuss at great length in both our original and reply briefs, discuss that.
Well, those cases decided not to overturn the Algiers Accords. They didn't decide that they would overturn the Algiers Accords. And more important, they specifically said in Roeder that the purpose of this is to be sure that Congress knew what it was doing. I'm going to just quote to you from Roeder 2, which says, legislation abrogating international agreements, quote, must be clear to ensure that Congress and the presidents have considered the consequences. Now, there's nothing here to indicate that Congress considered the consequences of abrogating an international agreement.
Well, what is clear, if you look at the statute, is that the Secretary is directed to require each such operator to have a valid medical certificate. No exceptions, no ambiguity, no lack of clarity there.
But no clarity that they were intending to overturn, that Congress knew that what it was going to do was to overturn an executive agreement.
If you look at the decision in Roeder 1 and Roeder 2, it is abundantly clear in the end that they sustained the Algiers Accords because the later enacted statutes were ambiguous, not because they failed to mention in any way the Algiers Accord.
But nonetheless, there is no case like this one. That is no, there's no case that would do what you want to do in this case. Is that right?
The opposite has been rejected on grounds that would cause you to reject the converse, which is before you, where a pre-existing international agreement should be considered abrogated because of the complete lack of ambiguity in the later enacted statute. The statute is clear. The Secretary must require every driver to have a valid medical certificate. In Roeder 2, the petitioner asked the Supreme Court for review, and as we point out in our first brief, the Solicitor General of the United States pointed out that this court in Roeder 2 did not require a clear statement of intent to overcome the Algiers Accords. The Algiers Accords were allowed to have effect because the subsequently enacted statute was ambiguous. I think that Solicitor General's statement, just commenting on what this court decided, controls here. And that there is a clear...
I didn't know of a rule that says the Solicitor General's views can control this court.
Well,
if that were true, the Justice Department would be very happy about that.
They probably would be. But when the Solicitor General comes out with a statement of the law, I think it trumps opposing counsel's contrary statement. There is no plain statement rule that ought to control here. And, of course, you don't get to reach this complex issue if there is no international agreement that creates a conflict with the latest statute, and that certainly is the case with the 1991 MOU.
What were you saying about the Canadian agreement?
The Canadian agreement does make reference to the process and procedure for determining qualifications. So the argument that we make with respect to Mexico does not apply to Canada. If you overturn Canada, it's going to be because the statute is clear and unambiguous, regardless of whether there's a conflict with the...
Does it matter that the agreement in Canada does not involve the Secretary of Transportation, but rather an associate administrator for motor carriers?
We have not argued that that is a...
I appreciate that, but I'm wondering. I mean, if the reason for concern, the reason we have a canons that strain not to find abrogation is we're concerned about decisions by the executive, we don't have the president, we don't have the Secretary of Transportation, we don't even have the head of a bureau, we have an associate administrator.
I think it stands on less firm ground than certainly an Article II treaty.
Going back to Chief Judge Garland's earlier line of questions, although perhaps the case doesn't do what he was asking you about Whitney versus Robertson and Casey's citing it. Have they not repeatedly said that if the statute and the international agreement cannot be reconciled, then the later in time controls?
That is the general rule, yes, Your Honor. I think you've stated
it. I'm not sure why you didn't mention that, but it's in your brief.
They're in the brief.
No, I think your response was fair. You think that the dicta in those cases, which says just what Judge Santel said, would govern. And I was only asking you whether there's actually been a case which has actually put it to a court to make a decision on that.
This may be one of the first cases in which the reverse of that proposition, the corollary proposition, is before the court. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Dana Karasvong for the government in this case. This court recently held that U.S. law permits Mexican truckers to use their Mexican commercial driver's licenses and to rely on those licenses as proof of medical fitness to drive. That case, the court was looking at the same statutory provision, 301.149, and the decision there makes sense because it's consistent with the agreements and the long course of dealing between the United States and Canada and the United States and Mexico. As the court has pointed out, the statute says nothing about overriding those agreements and that long course of dealing. And in this delicate field of international relations, there must be present, as the Supreme Court said in McCullough, the affirmative intention of Congress clearly expressed. We would expect in a situation like this.
And you, to take the opposite question that I asked previous counsel, can you point to any case in which there was a clear, where the court said these two are inconsistent with each other, the later statute is inconsistent, but there is nothing in the words of the statute that references the treaty, so we won't go forward. Is there any case that goes as far as you are asking us to go here?
Well, in Cook, which was the case about the customs officials, statute said they could search vessels within 12 miles of shore, and the committee reports, debates, the court said, made no reference to the treaty. And the treaty with the UK, or with, I believe, Britain at that point, didn't allow us to search vessels that were, you know, more than an hour for shore. The court said that the agreement overrode that subsequent agreement, and it pointed out that any doubt.
Did it say that the agreement overrode, or just that?
I'm sorry.
All that was done was to reenact the statute that had already been there, and that everybody understood that the statute had previously been modified by the treaty, and so the reenactment just continued the modification.
That's right, Your Honor. So the later enacted statute didn't abrogate the treaty in spite of its general language. Another example would be Chu Hung, where the court said that the statute was ambiguous, as we say this statute is, but it was the same kind of statute that required everyone to have...
That brings me to a question. I'm sorry.
Please.
How do you interpret, if you say there's an ambiguity here, how do you interpret the words of this statute so as to illustrate an ambiguity which can be resolved by upholding the international agreement? I guess that was an awkward way of wording that. But can you tell me what your interpretation of the statute is that's consistent with your position on the international agreement?
Yes, our interpretation of the statute is that only drivers licensed by the U.S., not drivers licensed under these international agreements, need to have this kind of medical certificate that otherwise, as was true with the longstanding exception.
You have the statute in front of you?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay. Give me the words that are subject to that interpretation.
Certainly, Your Honor. The statute says each such operator, that's in section C1B, now, each such operator shall have a medical certificate. That's a little bit ambiguous, right? It doesn't say any operator, domestic or foreign. It certainly doesn't say, as this court said, would be...
If it says each such operator, why isn't that inclusive? Why would it have to say domestic or foreign?
Well, Your Honor, again, we're looking at the clear statement. As this court said in Roeder, the fact that that is a, even if that is a good reading of the statute, that isn't enough. It has to be completely clear.
That's the question that I think we're both trying to come to. If it's unambiguous, what rule of law can say that an international agreement of earlier date overrides a statute of later date?
Well, I want to point the court to Chau Hung, and I think this kind of general language isn't considered to be unambiguous, sufficient to override a treaty.
That's what I'm asking you for, is where is the ambiguity in this language? If you have, now forget the question of whether it mentions international agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Assume for purposes of this discussion that you have an international agreement and a statute that are inconsistent. I understand there may be ways to try to talk about it, but I'm asking you about if there is an irreconcilable inconsistency, doesn't the latter have to control? Under Whitney v. Robertson and lots of later cases, it may be dicta, but Supreme Court dicta is awfully important to us.
So there's no irreconcilable inconsistency here.
That's what I'm trying to get to next. What is the ambiguity in this statute that keeps it from being inconsistent with what you say the purport of the international agreements is?
So the statute says each such operator. I think that's probably best read as a reference to the previous paragraph. You know, who are these operators who have to have the medical certificates? And in C1A, the secretary shall establish medical standards for operators. So the operators are the ones for whom the secretary is establishing the medical standards.
Right.
But pursuant to this.
When it says each such, that seems to get all of them, counsel. It doesn't say each such operator, paren, except for the ones who came from Mexico or except for the ones who came from Canada. It's just each such operator. I don't see how it could be much more inclusive than that.
Well, Your Honor, the operators for whom the secretary establishes standards, that's not the operators from Mexico and Canada, right? Pursuant to our longstanding agreements, those operators are under.
Yeah, so that's the problem, is whether the agreements can stand in the face of the statute. You're in a circle when you tell me that.
Your Honor, I thought the problem was whether the statute is so clear, as this court said in Roeder, that it ensures that the President and Congress have considered the consequences in this delicate field. And here there is ambiguity. There's further ambiguity if we look at the statutory scheme as a whole, right? We don't just look at this 2005 statute in a vacuum. There is a subsequent statute, the 2007 statute, which this court said made clear that Mexican commercial driver's licenses are permissible. Right, that statute asked the secretary to put together a list of requirements for which it would accept compliance with corresponding Mexican law in lieu of U.S. law, and that was to include commercial driver's license requirements. So that statute, as this court said, when, you know, in holding that U.S. law does permit Mexican truckers to use their Mexican commercial driver's license and rely on those as proof of medical fitness, that statute has to be read together with the 2005 statute.
What year was that statute?
That was 2007.
You're saying that statute wouldn't make any sense if it wouldn't be good enough to have a license if you also needed a separate medical certificate and couldn't get it because you weren't on the National Registry. So that Congress, in passing that, is indicating that it wants drivers who get a license and that's all that's required.
Yes, Your Honor, you have to look.
Is that what you're saying?
That is part of what I'm saying. Yes, I'm also saying that in telling the secretary to put together this list of things for which compliance with the Mexicans' requirements satisfies the U.S. law, that indicates that the secretary does have that power. We also need to look at the regulatory scheme, right, this long-standing exception. The regulation goes back to 1940 with general language similar to the language that is in this statute. But since the agreements, it's never been applied to Mexico and Canada. When we entered into that agreement with Mexico in 1991, there was a Federal Register notice explaining that Mexican drivers would not be required to carry a separate medical certificate. And, you know, if you compare that to the kind of language that was enough in Rota, right, notwithstanding any other authority, the statute, the actual statute in Rota 2 said the court shall hear a claim if, under this section, if the act is related to case number, whatever. And the court said, well, related to, it's not completely clear that that includes cases that are closed.
Which words are you relying on as similar to the Rota words?
No, I'm sorry. Rota, like the statute, is ambiguous. And
yes,
the court.
Which words in this statute do you regard as ambiguous as in Rota?
Well, I think each such operator is ambiguous, and I think there's further ambiguity.
Why can that mean anything except each of the operators who fit within the prior paragraph?
Right, and the operators within the prior paragraph are the ones that the secretary is regulating. The secretary is not regulating and has for decades not regulated the medical requirements for...
That's again, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't quite hear.
To regulate commercial operators and not to have anything exempted from it because they're from Mexico or Canada.
Well, this is general.
I'm asking you why that isn't the case, and you're telling me because the secretary doesn't regulate them. That's not getting there.
Well, Your Honor, when Congress enacts a statute like this, it does it against the backdrop of these longstanding regulations, this longstanding administrative
therefore,
practice.
Therefore, if there is any ambiguity, we have to resolve it in favor of consistency. And what both Judge Garland and I are probing for, Chief Judge Garland and I are probing for, is what's the ambiguity from which we're supposed to decide that Congress didn't mean what it said by each such operator?
And there are three sources of ambiguity here, the text, this each such
operator.
That's the
only one that's important to me, frankly.
Well, not just the text of this statute, but the statutory scheme as a whole, the 2007 statute.
Where do you discuss the 2007 statute in your brief?
I believe it's at page 23, Your Honor.
Okay. Excuse me, go ahead.
Sorry, I just have to pull it up if you to confirm that page number. I'm sorry, 32 and 33.
33.
My numbers backwards. And then in addition, of course, there's this regulatory scheme. As the court said in Cook, any doubt about the meaning of the statute is resolved by the consistent department practice existing before the statute's enactment. And this is the kind of situation where you would expect Congress to expressly consider the effect, right? There are hundreds of billions of dollars in international trade with Mexico and with Canada every year. 172 million trucks crossed our borders with Mexico and Canada between 1995 and 2005. And, you know, when Mexico previously introduced tariffs in 2009 in response to the 2009 appropriations rider, Congress immediately the following year reacted and removed that provision.
That's an excellent reason, perhaps, for having an agreement that would allow what you want here. But that would seem, would it not, to be properly addressed to the executive and perhaps to Congress rather than to this court. We have to construe the agreements that exist, and perhaps this is a good reason why you'd like to have the agreement that exists. But if there is a statute that overrides it, that doesn't matter to us. We can't make the policy decision. In fact, since the president, administration at least, and Mexico seem to be on board the proposition you want, why can't they just make a new agreement, which would be later in date than the statute, and get exactly what you want?
Well, Your Honor, of course there are consequences to actions that Mexico might perceive as being inconsistent with the agreements that we've already entered into. As we saw when Mexico began imposing these tariffs in 2009, and Congress responded to that, the President responded to that. If you're suggesting that this memorandum of understanding with Mexico is not consistent, that agreement addresses the question of who is going to be responsible for medical certifications. And it says each country is going to be responsible for its own drivers. But even if there were ambiguity...
What's the date of that agreement?
What?
What's the date of that memorandum?
That is 1991. It was implemented in the Federal Register in 92.
What's the date of the statute?
Well, as the court has pointed... The date of the statute, of course, is 2005. As the court has pointed out, there is no example of a case where this kind of general language has been taken to override a pre-existing...
Neither have you given a case where there isn't a construction of the statute that's consistent with the prior agreement in which a court has said that an earlier memorandum, an earlier agreement can override a later statute.
Well, I'd like to talk about Cho Hung. There, the court said that the statute was ambiguous, just as we say the statute is ambiguous here. But that statute, just like the statute here, required everybody to have a certain certificate. And it said that certificate would be the only acceptable proof in that case of residence. And the court said, no, that statute can't be interpreted to override our pre-existing treaty with to abrogate our pre-existing treaty with China.
And Cho Hung involved interpretation.
Yes, and this case...
This one, I'm still asking for an interpretation of the statute that is consistent with what you say, the agreement requires.
Well, Your Honor, I know that you're not sympathetic to my textual argument, but there, I do have a textual argument. There's also the statutory scheme, the fact that Congress is assumed to preserve, not abrogate, the background understandings against it regulates. Also, the principle of statutory construction that I'm evoking here, right? Congress legislates with an awareness of those, or presumed awareness of those principles, including the one here that requires a clear statement of Congress's intent to override a pre-existing treaty.
What's the reason that the government is willing to accept the Canadian and Mexican medical examiners, the certificates issued by them? What's the reason? Is there a safety reason? I mean, it can't only be that the government wants to trade. There must also be some view that they are sufficient from a safety point of view. Is that right?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the concerns that motivated Congress in passing this law, that in the U.S. these certificates don't have to be issued by doctors, right? They can be issued by nurses, by physician's assistants, even by chiropractors. And there was real concern that these people issuing these certificates in the U.S. didn't know the standards. That's not true in Canada and Mexico.
How do we know that? Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted. Go ahead.
Certainly, Canada has to be a doctor. In Mexico, it's usually a government doctor at a government facility. It's the same process as for airline pilots.
Well, if that is true, and I take it to be true because you told us, it's also in your briefs, then why can't the department issue a regulation that says that we will put on the National Register of Medical Examiners anyone certified by Mexico or Canada as a doctor who certifies truckers.
Well,
why can't you do that?
I don't think that's the best reading of this provision. The Secretary regulates these doctors. It regulates their training.
The best reading of what provision?
It
doesn't have to be the best reading. It only has to be a permissible reading. So my question is, why can't you fix this problem by putting those doctors on the National Registry? And if there's training that you think is absolutely required of a doctor for this, then you'll either have to ensure that they get that training, or you'll have to certify that the training that they do get is as good as the training that the Americans get, which I assume you think is true, otherwise you wouldn't be supporting this position.
Well, the training that the Secretary requires under this statute is training on the U.S. law, and that doesn't make sense for the Mexican and Canadian doctors to implement.
The training of New York. We're talking about medical questions, not
right. The training of the medical requirements in the U.S. as opposed to the medical requirements in Mexico or in Canada.
Is there anything in the statute that says it has to be training on medical requirements in the U.S.?
Well, I believe it's training on the medical standards established by the Secretary,
right,
but
so
also.
Pause and consider what I'm asking you. Why can't the Secretary say that Mexico can established standards, and if we think they're good enough, that we'll put those doctors on our national registry.
I'm not sure that's impossible, Your Honor, but I don't think it's required by the statute. The standards...
Assume for the minute you lose this case, okay? I want you to assume that. I know that hurts, but assume you lose. Why can't you get exactly what you want by issuing a regulation that says that the standards of medical examiners in Mexico and Canada are, as far as we're concerned, equivalent to, good enough, or whatever, to the ones in the United States. So we will put those doctors on the national register if they are approved by the Canadian and Mexican authorities.
I'm not sure that we couldn't do that, Your Honor, but the statute and the regulations require a lot of reporting from these doctors.
Forget about the regulations. So the regulations are in your authority. You can change the regulations. It's the statute that I'm concerned about.
Right. The statute also requires reporting. It requires training. I'm not sure that, because the Secretary doesn't regulate doctors in Mexico and Canada. And remember, there have been real effects from Mexico and Canada perceiving the United States as not complying with their requirements of these agreements, right? Mexico went to NAFTA and imposed...
If you're worried about not complying, then issue a regulation that complies. The problem here is, at least possibly the problem here, is if you issued a regulation that complies with respect to licenses, but not with respect to the specific requirement that medical examiner has to be listed in the National Registry. That may be that the Department of Transportation is the one that's erred here, and the solution is for the Department of Transportation to issue such regulation.
Your Honor, this Court has already held that U.S. law permits Mexican truckers to rely on their licenses as proof of medical fitness to drive.
You don't really actually think that case, the ICI case, resolves this case, do you? Because it specifically says, with respect to this issue, that the pilot program hasn't begun yet. Right?
It does say that, but I think that's an alternative holding. If you look at the previous sentence, it says, talks about the certificate and the registration requirements. It cites this provision, 31149D, and it says the Secretary fulfilled that requirement by finding that the issuance of a Mexican commercial driver's license, which requires a physical examination every 2 years, provides proof of medical fitness to drive. Now, if there are no further questions...
So you're saying that we're actually bound by the previous case, that the second is an alternative holding, moreover, which begins with the word moreover, suggesting possibility of an alternative holding, and that...
And that
case already resolves this case, is that right?
I do think that case certainly resolves the question of whether these commercial driver's licenses can be relied on as proof of medical fitness.
Can you tell me what page that language is again?
It's on page 8 of the slip opinion. That's
eight.
8 and 9. Okay. Eight over to 9.
If there are no further questions.
Okay. Sounds like there are.
Of course, that case didn't consider Canada, but the reasoning as to Canada would be the same.
So it begins by saying the Drivers Association argues and that the physical exams required of truckers are performed by examiners who have received adequate training are listed on the registry. Secretary has fulfilled that requirement by finding that issuance of medical commercial license, which requires a physical exam every year and proof of medical fitness to drive. But then it says, moreover, the requirement that the examiner be listed on a national registry has not yet taken effect.
Yes, Your Honor, I read that moreover sentence as an alternative holding. Of course, if you read it differently, I do think that this, as the court said, there's no example of general language in a statute like this being taken to override an international agreement.
Nor is there any case that has ever said that when you have an irreconcilable agreement and a later statute, the later statute has to yield. And going back to the Supreme Court cases in the 19th century, there is language, albeit dicta, that says that if you can't reconcile them, then the later controls.
Yes.
You're stuck with that, and you have no case in the country. You can say all the times you want to that they have no case that's done the opposite, but neither of you have a case on yours.
Well, Your Honor, I do have Chiu Hung, which just like in this case requires...
Chiu Hung expressly says if you can't reconcile them, letter control doesn't it?
But if you look at the actual text in that statute, there was a certificate requirement just like the certificate requirement here. It was a general language, and the court found that to be ambiguous and not clear enough to override the agreement. If there are no further questions.
Go ahead, Mr. Cole.
I'll make three brief points. In listening to opposing counsel, I saw no useful reconstruction of the 1991 MOU. It doesn't create obligations on the United States with respect to medical certification. With respect to ambiguity, they did not argue ambiguity to any extent at all in their briefs, and I think the statute is very clear. The secretary is responsible for the safety of the highways of the country. If any of us are driving up the New Jersey Turnpike and get sideswiped by a truck where the driver has just had a spontaneous heart attack because he's had a lifelong heart condition, it doesn't matter whether it's a Canadian truck, a Mexican truck, or a U.S. truck. We're in trouble.
Same thing with respect to driver's licenses, isn't that right?
That may be so, but driver's licenses and medical certification are distinctly separate in this country.
They are separate, but nonetheless, if somebody is hasn't been tested in the way that we test drivers and doesn't has different eyesight requirements, et cetera, which you said are not part of this, and they hit you, you're in trouble regardless, just the same as whether they have a heart attack. Isn't that right?
Well, yes, and that might go to the wisdom of the prior panel decision, which is not before us today. What I'm trying to say is that you are required to have a medical certificate, and 31149C1A1 talks about operators of motor vehicles. It doesn't talk about Canadian operators, Mexican operators, and U.S. operators. And wherever they come from, they have to satisfy the secretary of their medical qualifications. And they haven't.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure that I understand your argument. You're saying there is not a conflict between the statute, right? Because it doesn't say anything about medical certification.
There are no obligations under the 1991 agreement with Mexico imposing obligations on the secretary with respect to medical certification. Absent agreements, there is nothing for the 2005 statute to conflict with. So their argument has to be put to one side. But the secretary, if you look, there are very specific standards mentioned in our brief. Take a look at 49 CFR 390.105, 107, 113, and throughout that whole section. Examiners must be trained and tested every 10 years under our statute. It must be on the National Registry. Records are subject to federal and state oversight. They make a record and you can look at it. Examiners are subject to oversight and removal.
Where's that?
That will be at 49 U.S. Code 31149C2 and the implementing regulations so that they can, and it is extensively in our brief starting at page 25 of the main brief and I think 15 of the second brief, there are real oversight responsibilities that the secretary has because they were desperately concerned with the fact that any MD, whatever he knew about drivers or didn't know about drivers and the stresses put on drivers and the peculiar physical demands, any medical examiner could sign off on a piece of paper, and they've changed that. You have to know about drivers. You have to get training. You have to submit to testing every 10 years. Your work is going to be scrutinized, and if you give a lot of bogus approvals, we're going to take you off the list.
Is there anything that would prevent them from putting the way the government describes the doctors in Mexico, it describes them as almost exclusively by physicians at Mexican government facilities, and when performed by private doctors, those doctors are specifically approved by the Mexican Department of Transportation. Is there anything that would prevent the department from putting those Mexican doctors on the National Registry?
Nothing would prevent that if they complied with the regulations that I just mentioned.
Well, is there anything in the regulations?
If they were trained and tested.
But right, and is there anything that would prevent the secretary from saying the training and testing can be done in Mexico by the Mexican government or by the Mexican Medical Association or any other thing like that?
If they met U.S. standards, that's theoretically possible.
It's just standards of the secretary.
If they were trained and tested against the Secretary of U.S. Secretary's standards, if they did that in Mexico, that would be an interesting question. They might be able to get by with that. I don't want to concede that in open court right now because it's a hypothetical, but it's a possibility. There's no reason why a Mexican doctor or a Canadian doctor cannot be on the registry, the U.S. registry. How you get there and what testing and all that and how that's accommodated is a different question, but that is one possible solution to the problem. And I think, based on the court's questions, I have nothing further. I think you have a pretty good idea of what the issues are.
Further questions? We'll take the matter under submission. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.